The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. For the most comprehensive industry news and information, visit our website at irei.com and sign up for our free daily news alerts.
This is Mike Consul with Jeff Dorman. Welcome to the Dorman Report. New data just out shows that Blackstone raised a staggering $49.4 billion during 2016, Jeff. And when compared to the second place firm, Lone Star Funds, which raised $18.6 billion, it was just no contest, not to mention all the other firms that were in the process of fundraising during the past year, during 2016. What, we all know that Blackstone has been the very hot investment shop, but just in terms of its performance, does it actually warrant more than a threefold year of fundraising vis-a-vis the number two ranked firm?
Well, I can only go on rumor. And the rumor is that performance has held up pretty good over time. The problem with assessing opportunity fund performance is you can't do it the traditional way that real estate investors typically look at things, like a time-weighted rate of return. At least you can't for the opportunity fund side of their business. They now have a core open-ended fund and do other types of strategies. But so there really isn't any benchmark you can go look against and see how they're doing. Just anecdotally, talking to investors, they seem exceptionally pleased with the performance over time. But I think more importantly, what this really talks to is Blackstone's brand. Blackstone, by far, is the most well-known, most well-recognized brand in the real estate investment market. You may not know who many of the players are in the market, but you probably know who Blackstone is. And I think what it shows you is the value of establishing and maintaining a brand. You know, you're talking about 2.68 times the next closest competitor in terms of the amount of capital that they've been raising. And I think if you do talk to the Blackstone people, they will tell you that the one way you can lose your job at Blackstone is do anything to damage the brand. So this is not by chance. This is something that they have thought about, planned about, strategized about. There's a brand that they've created. It has to do with high quality. It has to do a lot of different things. And they will defend that brand to the death, and it works. And they've also advertised heavily over the years to establish that brand in multiple different markets, just not with us.
Well, you know, it's interesting you say if you talk to them, and one of the hardest things to do in this business is to actually get somebody from Blackstone on the phone to talk. And one of the few times I was able to do that, one of the points that was made was that, you know, we really just stay focused. We're focused on the work we have to do, and we don't really want to be distracted by all the ancillary things orbiting around the business. And when you talk about maintaining a brand and sticking to your knitting, as Warren Buffett likes to say, it sounds like Blackstone has gotten that religion.
Yeah, I think, you know, that's always been kind of the thing. Although they have, at one time, the only focus they had was opportunity funds, and they only did opportunity funds in sequence. Today, they may have two or three different funds in the market. You know, a European strategy, an Asia strategy, a global strategy, U.S. strategy, and maybe also an open-end fund, and maybe even a value-added strategy. So they aren't quite as focused as they at one time were. And yet their team seem to be very focused on achieving the specific objectives they lay out for their funds. I don't want to be a big proponent or an advocate for anybody. That's not my role or my job to be, and it's not our company's job to be. But you have to admire what they've accomplished over time. It isn't that they've done it for 2 years or 3 years or 4 years or 5 years. This has been pretty much from the very early days of the firm. They very quickly kind of set themselves out from the pack as the premium brand in the market. And then they've done nothing but strengthen that brand and grow that brand strength over time, and the assets have followed.
Well, and I've heard you say over time, Jeff, that nobody's hot forever. And obviously Blackstone's not going to be hot forever. So it kind of begs the question that with nearly $50 billion committed to Blackstone investments during 2016, this hugely disproportionate amount, I say disproportionate, that's subjective, of course, it would seem there's so much money with one organization that if Blackstone was to go on tilt, that's an awful lot of money that is somehow not with the hottest shop anymore. Now, I understand that there are not all of that $50 billion is in any particular asset class, but nonetheless, I mean, is that would that give you pause at all?
Look, nothing lasts forever. Nobody ends up being at the top of the market forever and ever and ever. But this company has proved that it can do it for a very long time. The only other company I've ever seen accomplish that over time was the old Equitable Real Estate Investment Management. They were, you know, the top firm in terms of assets under management for almost 20 years on a consecutive year-in, year-out basis. And everybody else was struggling to kind of pick up market share against them, but they continued to pick up market share and get stronger and stronger. There are a number of reasons why that happened. They're quite different from the reason it's happening at Blackstone, but one thing they definitely both shared in common is a real strong client focus and a real strong commitment to defending the brand and positioning the brand. Both firms have spent very heavily to develop and strengthen their brands.
Now, you've been around the whole fundraising business for a long time, Jeff, and obviously performance is key. What other factors, though, come into play?
You know, you could say, where is Blackstone vulnerable? And I'm sure they know where they're vulnerable, too. But from an outsider's perspective, where I would say they'd be vulnerable, obviously they've got a lot of their brand is wrapped up in their people. And John Gray is still a relatively young man, but there's been talk for years about John being the heir apparent to take over and step into a larger role at Blackstone. That could happen. May not happen, may never happen, but it could happen. And the question would be, who's underneath him? Well, who's underneath him has a lot of talented people. Question is there anybody who has the same set of talents and client skills that John has and the same kind of vision and also commitment to staying on focus, staying on principle, not veering from, the overall strategy? You know, that's a question mark. It doesn't mean that there isn't somebody there, but that's a question mark that somebody legitimately might have. On the other hand, again, as I said, John's young and he doesn't seem to be going anywhere other than, you know, upwards in reputation in terms of what he's accomplished. There are some other people that are former JMBers that are at the firm that are getting into their 70s, and you got to believe at some point in time that they'll be leaving the firm. But on the other hand, you know, they've got a lot of people, you know, get a deep bench, so plenty of people to step up to take their place, and these folks have been there for a very long time, and so they've touched almost everybody that's been in the firm, so there's a good chance that, you know, those transitions will take place relatively smoothly. I would imagine they would. They've managed other things well. Why would they not manage that well? Another place where they might be vulnerable, however, would be in the number of assets that they're managing. The bigger you get, the more complex your portfolio gets. And the larger your asset base, the larger your individual plays and bets get, the more vulnerable you are to one mistake being somewhat catastrophic for the reputation of the firm. Again, they're very aware of this. I'm sure they think about it and talk about it all the time and probably turn down some even larger deals than the deals that they've done, specifically because of those risks. But that's an area where they could get out of whack. It's happened with other big firms before where, you know, a rogue investor with too much authority has committed too much of the firm's capital to, you know, a play that turns out to be not as well as expected. And I think even Blackstone would agree that they've been brilliant in their execution, they've been brilliant in their strategy, they've also been lucky. And, you know, there's an old saying, it's better to be lucky than smart, and I think they've been both smart and lucky. That'd be the best combination, wouldn't it, to be smart and lucky? The question is, does their luck continue to run, and who knows the answer to that question. But I don't see any portents that suggest that Blackstone's ready to drop off the face of the earth. They've been the strong lead player for at least the last 10 to 15 years, and my guess is they'll just continue to gather strength until or unless something happens to cause that not to be true any longer.
Yeah, just a monster performance, as you say.
Well, I'm not saying they've had monster performance. I don't have any data that would tell me what their performance is. All I can say is what I hear from their clients at board meetings and in casual conversations with people, and they have a lot of respect for this firm. So I can't imagine them having a lot of respect for the firm if they didn't perform well. I haven't heard anybody at these board meetings or elsewhere say, you know, they get a lot of credit for performance, but they really haven't performed very well. Never heard that from anybody.
Yeah, well, the objective measurement we can go with is a $50 billion fundraising year is phenomenal. So we'll go with that. Mm-hmm. And let's move on to a second subject here. We do have an upcoming Inside the Edition podcast, an interview with Jeff Canney, the CEO of National Real Estate Advisors. And his organization did something really interesting. They created a risk analysis tool that takes climate change into account, among other things. And when they run the matrix, it has surmised that Miami is a market that it will not build or invest in because of the likelihood of it being submerged in ocean water over time. Yet the article that he wrote points out that Miami has the largest percentage of commercial real estate under construction of any major city in the country right now. So obviously some builders and investors aren't as concerned as Jeff Canney and his team are at National Real Estate Advisors. What are your thoughts, Jeff?
Well, first of all, I would say that, you know, National Real Estate Advisors is kind of an interesting organization. It's one of those companies that probably isn't as well known as some of the larger firms, and yet really interesting in the way they look at the world and the kinds of investments they do and their strategic approach. So, you know, you got to pay some attention when they start to call attention to some of these things. The question I would ask, and I haven't read the article, so I'm not that familiar with what they're suggesting, but what's the time frame for the real risk that's associated with the Miami shoreline? You can go around the Mediterranean and find all kinds of cities that are underwater, including big parts of Alexandria, the ancient parts of Alexandria. So this isn't the first time we've seen, you know, water rising or seabed sinking. The question is, a lot of times what happened in those situations is the things happened abruptly and unexpectedly. And here we have a situation where we know that there's global warming, we know that there's glacial melting, we know that there's oceans rising, and we know that ocean temperatures are changing, and we know that ocean currents are changing. You know, what impact is that going to have, and how quickly is it going to have an impact on waterfront property in Miami or in, you know, any, you know, water or coastal properties in throughout all of Florida? I don't know. These guys are taking a look at it. It's probably good that we're taking a look at it. The real question, again, I think, has to be how soon are these things likely to happen, and therefore how soon are they likely to impact the value of the investments? And I guess what they're saying is maybe it's far out before you really start to see a real significant impact, but maybe the perception that it's closer than people think could be enough to start to undermine the value proposition, and they don't want to be in a position of holding property when value propositions are declining. That's their story, and they're sticking to it. You know, I haven't studied it the way that they've studied it. Maybe there'd be other investment managers that would say nonsense. But there's a lot of interest in Miami today, and a lot of it's coming from South America and offshore in terms of Miami residential. And so that's probably what's driving the building boom right now. Whenever there's a demand for space, people will build. And if you're building to sell, you're not really at risk. You're only at risk in terms of the window in which you're developing, getting your permits, getting everything up and running, and selling off. You might have some residual liability for, you know, faulty workmanship, but you're not going to be liable for the oceans rising.
Well, and you make an interesting point that other cities have encountered becoming waterlogged. And in fact, there are people in Miami who are already talking about Miami becoming the new Venice or Amsterdam, that the city, especially if the water level does actually rise by, I believe it's 6 feet, it's supposed to rise over the next couple or three decades. If that's gradual, then adjustments could be made. They already have intercoastal waterways. Obviously, some major adjustments would have to be made, but if it was gradual, maybe it could become a city like a new Venice or Amsterdam. I mean, it's some people think that's far-fetched. I don't know, but it's happened before, and it's not like we haven't improved our knowledge of engineering and our capabilities.
Well, Venice is sinking, and the waters are rising, so there's going to be more and more problems in cities like Venice. We've all seen pictures of the San Marco Plaza flooded. Doesn't happen every day, but it happens once in a while. It never used to happen at all. And that's how these things happen. You know, it's not like, wow, Miami's underwater, or wow, Venice is underwater. It starts out with different, you know, things happening more and more frequently. And that's probably what the future is likely to bring over time, unless something happens to reverse global warming, which doesn't look like there's anything that's going to be happening anytime soon in our lifetime to make that happen.
You know, I should also mention that one of the other factors is just the storm surge, hurricanes, and it is a vulnerable city on that score, and, as all of Florida really is. But, you know, one of the things that it brought to mind was several years ago, I don't remember when it was, but the state of Florida got hit with several hurricanes, and people were starting to think, this is the way it's going to be every year. This is global warming. This is climate change. And actually, things have really been pretty tame since then. And it kind of goes to the whole idea that how unpredictable everything around us is, including certainly climate.
Well, one of the things I've seen in my life is climate science has gotten better and better. But it's only gotten better by, it used to be that you couldn't predict what was going to happen tomorrow. And today, most of the time when they predict what's going to happen tomorrow, they're pretty right. It used to be that you couldn't predict what's going to happen a week from now. And today, they're not always right, but they're right more times than they're wrong. But you get out much beyond that, and they haven't gotten much better. You're talking about what Joshua Cooper Lawrence Ramo calls complexity. You're dealing with complex systems where a feather change can have huge impacts on the whole system. So it doesn't take much. Sometimes it's just the final grain of sand hitting a sand pile to cause the sides to cave in. And that's what you're dealing with when you're talking about weather systems. And we just don't understand the dynamics of those all that well yet. We may get better at it because with the deep learning that's been made possible because of the changes, innovations that have been made in computer technology, both hardware and software, really hitting a turning point around 2012, we may actually get much better at dealing with complexity. But right now, we're not very good at it.
So let's finish up by talking a little bit about your time on the road. As usual, you've been on the road somewhat. You've been making the rounds with industry people. What are some of the topics of conversation, and what is the confidence level out there right now?
Well, I think it's divided. I think the whole spectrum of potential scenarios are out before people's eyes. Some people are latching on to the optimistic scenario that suggests that there's nothing really on the horizon that anybody could see that would lead to a massive collapse of the real estate markets or even the economy. Most supply and demand in most markets for most property types are relatively imbalanced. There's some exceptions in the multifamily sector and some obsolete property in the retail sector and some turmoil in the retail sector. But beyond that, the retail sector, if you look at the numbers, is still performing pretty darn well. Industrial has been real strong. Office has always been an up and down. You know, the problem with offices, it always costs more to retenant it than you think it's going to cost. And certainly usually costs more to be tenant than you performed it to cost. And so it doesn't always deliver on what you expect it to deliver. But it's still the most investable asset class, so most of the money goes into office. That's always been the case since I've been in the business. I guess it will continue to be. Those optimists feel like there's nothing that's going to interrupt that. It should be continued clear sailing for several years. Other end of the spectrum are the people that feel like you might call them the chicken littles, are feeling like we've had 7 years of recovery. It's one of the longest recoveries in the history of economic life. It's certainly one of the longest real estate recoveries we've ever seen. And we're way overdue. There is more construction going on today. Even though construction starts recently were down a little bit. There's certainly more construction. You don't need statistics to see this. You just need to look at the skylines of your local community, and you see cranes there that weren't there before. Not all of it's spec, but there's just more of that happening. And so if you thought, you don't have to get way over your skis, you don't have to get way overbuilt, just get close to meeting the demand or slightly overbuilt, and then you have a huge demand contraction, and then all of a sudden game over. I think people are also concerned about automation and robotization, and what does that mean in terms of job creation? What does it mean in terms of the need for space? What does it mean in terms of the need for infrastructure, parking lots? All those various things are things that people are talking about. Nobody has a real answer, because what we're trying to do is predict today into the future, and we tend to think linearly on a straight line basis, and the reality of it is things don't work that way. Again, we're talking again about complex systems, and the ultimate outcomes are yet, you know, to unfold, and so we just don't know. You know, the Wall Street Journal just recently put out an article saying, actually arguing that all this over, what they call overhype of robotization and automation, suggested actually it's way under what people were projecting would have happened already by now. I don't know what the answer to the whole thing is, but it's a very interesting time. We're certainly going through a period of time in which the whole meaning of work is being called into question. And, you know, what are the jobs of the future? Who knows? You know, the jobs of the future used to be coding and medicine and all sorts of different research fields that may actually be done better by machine intelligence over time if we continue to move in the same direction we've been moving. And so maybe it shifts back to the human skills being more valued, the ability to kind of relate to another human being, the ability to empathize, the ability to help people deal with emotional issues. All of those things may be more important as we move forward. Although some people think machines will even be able to do that better than human beings, so who knows?